Bill Barnett has graciously decided to try to set up a Wikipedia type, a wiki type of thing for us, so that you might be able to use that, but I'm not sure how long it'll be before it's up and running, to have a discussion online about the tissue banking. The web pages have been, some of them have been updated. This week they're working on trying to get the contact list so that you could just go in there and press on one button and send it to a select group of principal investigators or other people involved in the consortium. So that may also be make it a little bit easier to get in contact with people. The administrative corps has requested a carryover budget, and I don't know whether you've received it yet or not, Susan, but there are funds in there to help assist Keith Miller's project, as well as to perhaps be able to fund two other small pilot projects. So consider that, and I'll have more information on that once I know that the carryover request has been approved. But that was about it from the admin corps. Are there people have any concerns or comments? Hopefully everyone's received everything that they should from the last meeting. Any comments? Michael, you have... I apologize in that I did not go into work yesterday, so I don't have my notebook from the last conference call to see what other items were on there. And so I'm still at home this morning.
Yeah, I don't see anything else. We had a couple of items from the meeting, from the clinical meeting, that we were going to carry forward.
Right.
Are you ready to do those?
I'm done going through what the administrative part of this has to do.
So, Tim, are you on?
Yes.
One of the suggestions that came from the clinical meeting was that with interesting data developing on ultrasound, in utero ultrasound, that it would be helpful to add that component to the sheep project so that we can correlate across species, and wondered if that's something that would be feasible to add to your project and what would be required to do so.
We have every intention of doing that, based on what I've heard and what I read in the last report. And the difficulty with our model is that in utero ultrasound is not as advanced and developed and as easy as it is in a woman. And however, we believe that there's a fair likelihood that we will be able to scan them as neonates and generate data that would be of interest.
Uh-huh.
And I have an appropriate machine for that, so no additional funding would be necessary.
Well, Tim, I had in the administrative request for carryover put in a kind of a fee-for-service to reimburse you for those ultrasound times. So if funds are needed, they may be available.
Okay.
Let me ask, what can be done? Ask Tim, what can be done prenatally to correlate with the clinical studies?
We can work on this, but there'll be some development time, I believe. I just hesitate to promise that there will be useful data, but there may be, and we can start working on that.
Can I ask a question? It's
sure.
Susan.
Yes.
Okay. Is it possible to scan, if you got the ultrasound part up and running and you found that it was easy to do, would you scan the pregnant sheep you have? Or would you not risk doing that to the sheep that you want neonates from and have to raise a separate set of sheep for the prenatal ultrasounds?
I think I think it would be prudent to use animals that are not in the study for piloting the prenatal scanning, because it could take, you know, it could be involve, you know, half an hour, hour to scan these animals and restrain them during that period of time. And the value of those animals is so high, the ones that are enrolled in the alcohol study, that I'd really hesitate to do that on animals that are in the study. On the other hand, the neonates, I think that's okay, because I think that it would be relatively speedily done.
Right.
I think that from my perspective, the concern here might be that the neonatal ultrasound is going to be outside the window of interest for comparison to the humans, and so there's sort of a trade-off as to whether that's really going to be that valuable or not. I mean, it'll be valuable in terms of understanding the neonatal status of the sheep, but it may not be for the comparative purposes that are being asked about here.
Well, the comparisons as far as measurements of across species, of course, aren't useful, but the fact that, you know, the independent measures will be carefully known in our species, I think it'll still, even though the animals will have been born, I think that it'll still shed some light on the human studies.
Any other?
Yeah. Is there anything that would that could be done, perhaps in an animal that was not in the study, a separate pilot kind of thing, to indicate the effects of alcohol prenatally? Is there that one of the major questions is what is happening with the fetus? In a woman who binge drinks during pregnancy, so to speak, you have the model, a possible model, and the question is, how can we look at the physiology or the or whatever of the fetus while that is in progress? You know, while administering alcohol.
Could you state some variables that you're interested in? Because we do, you know, we've already looked at cerebral blood flow and hemodynamics and endocrine function in utero. So I'm just curious what other dependent measures that you're interested in.
And you have correlated that with postnatal measures? Have you correlated that with postnatal measures?
No. No, we have not.
Well, those measures that you described would require sacrifice of the fetus at some point during pregnancy, right?
Yeah, all of our studies, except for my R21 looking at behavioral measures and the CIFAS studies, all of those pregnancies were ended at the end of the first trimester equivalent, which was at 133 days of gestation. So those animals and their tissues were utilized for cell counting. So we don't have any data on those same animals postnatally.
I guess I'd like to make a suggestion here, Faye and Tim, that if you try to develop, I mean, if there are funds available to try to develop an ultrasound approach to characterizing prenatal development in the sheep, the current models that we're looking at, as Tim pointed out, are so valuable, particularly because they start so early in pregnancy, and at least with the three trimester exposure, they extend for so long. The cost of trying to develop that in those doesn't make sense when the other goals are have the priority. But if there are ways to fund an approach that would allow, for example, a first trimester exposure that then is followed by abstinence during rest of the pregnancy, and then using ultrasound to characterize, you know, second or third trimester development. I'm talking about second and third trimester equivalent development, and then assess that, and then perhaps postnatal behavior. If you know, that's a pretty big project, and so I don't know that can be done as sort of a supplemental funding kind of approach, but I think developing the ultrasound approach might be feasible in a completely separate set of animals.
Yeah, I have interest in developing it. So, we will work with our radiologists and ultrasonographers to begin piloting animals that are not part of the study to see the feasibility of the prenatal measurements, but I just can't promise that yet.
Okay. Michael, there were some other things.
Yeah, let me bring up the other issues that were interesting from the clinical meeting. A issue that was discussed is how to make sense of the findings in the human imaging studies of areas of increased thickness, cortical thickness in some brain areas, and the likelihood that imaging is not going to tell us their way to look to see, for example, if there's been a failure to prune non-functional synapses or to look at what the cytoarchitecture might be of cortical regions that are thick. You're going to have some imaging of the sheep brains. There's the possibility of trying to reproduce the finding in animals, but then to do what the animals allow us to do that can't be done in humans, which is to define the cellular change. So, Tim, I wonder what your thoughts are on that.
The tissue will be, the tissue at a single time point at the end of our studies will be available for cortical studies. We haven't factored in support for doing those studies, but the tissue will be generated.
Mm-hmm.
There's I was going to bring this up at the clinical conference call. There's a recent data that were presented at the ICANA meetings that really didn't show the extent of cortical thickness that Elizabeth did. They showed some, but it was very selective in a lot smaller regions than Elizabeth's data. And I know that Elizabeth's
data were dead?
Yes.
Whose data were those?
A guy by the name of Brian Schweisberg. And he is using images that we collected here. I know Elizabeth and he were both at the ICANA meeting, and they discussed the possible differences in their data. He did find some regions of cortical thickness in the parietal lobe, but they were not nearly, the significance of those was not nearly the same as in Elizabeth's study, where she found very large areas.
And are these different study, Ed, are these different study populations?
Different study populations, yeah.
Good morning.
How do they differ?
That we don't know yet.
Uh-huh.
The data that I think Elizabeth used were some of the data that we had collected in San Diego,
yeah,
as well as some of the data that she's collected on UCLA.
Yeah. And but are the kids the same age when they're imaged?
They are. She has a much heavily methamphetamine-exposed group, although I don't want to say anything because I'm not sure whether or not she excluded those from those alcohol analysis.
Right, but both groups, are they the same age?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
But there certainly are differences. When you look at the slides, it's pretty obvious that he did not totally replicate the severity or the quantitative the amount of cortical thickness that Elizabeth found. I mean, he still found some, but it was not nearly as dramatic.
Right. Okay.
And so I wanted to talk to Elizabeth to see what they had discussed about possible reasons for those differences.
Uh-huh.
Used slightly different techniques, and that Brian was primarily interested in white matter and diffusion tensor imaging, but he did come up with measures of cortical thickness as well. So, and I was not at the ICANA meeting, so I don't have all the details yet. It's just that I knew the data because Brian sent me his PowerPoint presentation.
Right.
So. It is interesting that in mice, the cortical thickness changes not in the perforation zone, but only on the differentiating zones. I wonder, on the other hand, the temporal cortex, where they have extended the cortical thickness, whether these two zoning are contributing the differences.
I don't know. I'm trying to pull up Brian's slides right now to see where he found his. Let's see what it says here. Cortical thickness. Hold on 1 second.
So while Ed looks for that, let me raise a third question that came up at the clinical meeting, and it has to do with the fact that measurements of palpebral fissure have proved so valuable in identifying facial dysmorphology, fetal alcohol syndrome, and that this may represent, among other things, changes in the volume of the ocular globe. And the question was raised as to whether we couldn't use imaging of the ocular globe to determine volume, to help correlate palpebral fissure width with the volume of the ocular globe, but to correlate perhaps volume of the ocular globe better with some of the brain morphology changes than perhaps palpebral fissure width would do. And an opportunity, again, to do some of that more easily in animals than can be done in humans. So the question was whether we couldn't do ultrasound of the ocular globe in sheep, and whether even in some of Kathy's work with the imaging, we could try to come up with measurements of the ocular globe that is a better surrogate measurement of changes in brain development than the palpebral fissure, which indirectly reflects changes in not only the ocular globe but the orbit. And just put that out for discussion.
I think in our proposal we had said we were going to, in fact, look at globe volumes. If we didn't, it was a big oversight. It's an important thing to do. I think a confounder, though, is that in the mice we have this predisposition to having globe size reductions. And so if, in fact, and maybe that's the case in people who are affected too, I don't know, but I think adding the sheep into that would certainly be really, really good.
And I guess I'd follow up, which is I know that you and Fung are exchanging your substrains, and wouldn't it be interesting if Fung's didn't have the same propensity for ocular globe changes, and perhaps you would be able to determine whether the substrain that is predisposed to ocular globe problems have more frontal lobe problems, for example.
Yeah, I'd expect that, but it adds on a whole other group of experiments, because I think we were kind of at the point of deciding we needed to pick between one or the other substrains.
Right.
If we end up then needing to actually use both and do comparisons, it adds on a lot more imaging time and a lot more, therefore, a lot more money.
Some of the pilot data probably can be looked at with the micro video, which is a little bit faster and much less cost. But I don't know how many group of animals we'll get other than the initial comparisons.
How accurate do you think the micro video is in terms of determining globe volume?
Probably the ocular size.
I'm sorry?
Probably more measuring the ocular size.
So, Tim,
yes.
How feasible is it to do ultrasound in the sheep to determine ocular globe volumes?
Well, I'm fairly certain that just a B-mode measurements would be very simple to do. So, and they'd be simple and accurate. And I'm not well enough educated on clinical ultrasonography on the volume issue. If there are algorithms to derive volume from such as B measurements, but I can look into that.
I guess one thing that would be easy enough to do it would be to measure the volume postmortem.
Yes. Yes.
Using Archimedes' principle or something similarly simple.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then you can directly correlate, at least at that phase, what turned out to be. I don't know if sheep have palpebral fissures, but or whether people have measured it, but maybe to look at the correlation between changes in ocular globe size and some of the brain changes, and that wouldn't really add anything in cost.
No.
If you could do it in utero, you might have the opportunity to see it developing during the third trimester.
We will look into that.
And the palpebral fissure measure will be obtained at the end of end phase of the sheep model too, because of the
Great.
Direct measures that you take.
Uh huh.
And then I just sent everybody a paper looking at the relationship between facial development in human and the mouse. So that Elizabeth Moore provided me. So you might find that useful in trying to do the relationship studies between the primates, I mean the humans and the mouse.
And I guess for Kathy, another question is, in addition to the size of the ocular globe, is there reason to believe that the architecture of the ocular orbit changes and whether that contributes to the change in palpebral fissure size?
Well, the orbit size is dependent on globe size. So the globe comes first, the orbit comes, the bony tissue around it comes later.
Uh-huh.
I would expect they're going to be directly, they'll go right hand in hand. I think looking at bony orbits, if there's a good way of looking at the bony orbits, and maybe the CT is a good way of doing that, to measure orbit size should tell you the same thing as looking at globe size.
Okay.
I'll just throw out a couple of extra things that were talked about. We talked about banking genetic material for human and animal studies, and a subgroup consisting of Tatiana, Tim, and I guess Charlie are looking at that.
Tina as well.
And Tina. Possibly looking at buccal swabs to do a GWAS study, a genome-wide association study. Some sort of issues related to the logistics of the banking. There was an appeal, again, for biomarkers. This will coincide with the later part of our discussion here, which you should begin to think about, which is what should we be soliciting in terms of developmental studies and what area do we want to help develop? And from the clinical group was, of course, a plea for biomarkers because of the challenge that they face in really determining how much alcohol their subjects are ingesting during pregnancy, something that we can measure directly in the animal studies, and metabolomics as a way of getting at some of the biomarkers, whether that approach would be fruitful. So that was proposed. Dental analysis was another thing that came up. This is, I guess, my last effort to lean on sheep. There was a question raised about whether measurements between the lateral incisors might be a surrogate measure of holoprosencephaly, and whether that could be done with prenatal ultrasound, and whether in sheep might be some indirect measurements of the premaxilla and frontonasal process that would take us closer to knowing whether there's something in the teeth. I haven't looked at this since the meeting, but we did a quick search while we were there and found that there were a number of dental issues identified in older papers, including malocclusion and some other things. And I guess Ken Jones was very interested in this possibility and would welcome people's comments on that.
So I think with the teeth, the ones you'd want to look at is the upper central incisors. Is that what you said? I think maybe said lateral incisors.
Yeah, that's what Ken suggested, was the lateral ones.
Really? I think you need to look at the upper centrals.
And why is that, Kathy?
Because they're more, they're midline. They're closer to the midline, and they're definitely from the part of the that premaxillary tissue. There's some question about the derivation of the tissue for the lateral incisors. In fact, it looks like part of the laterals come from a little part of the developing face that is called maxillary prime. So it's not associated directly with the forebrain. It's more related to the diencephalon midbrain, more midbrain area effects.
Uh-huh.
You'd want to look at the centrals. And
yeah.
While I have the floor here, and I've been thinking about the orbit thing.
Yeah.
In our mice, we have a lot of asymmetry of effect. So one eye can be affected to a great extent and the other one not. And
right.
I would expect that effect on the eye is going to be reflected in the brain. And so the question is, in people, if they're finding globe deficiencies, are they finding any asymmetries? Because if they are, it would be a perfect opportunity to compare the right and left halves of the brain and see if the side where the eye is smaller also has a smaller brain or forebrain on that size or on that side or whatever, if there's a sidedness that correlates either directly or indirectly with the eye thing.
It's an interesting question, and one that if the orbit or the globe is a surrogate, if the palpebral fissure is a surrogate for the orbit,
right?
There should be good data even within our database now about asymmetries in palpebral fissure size.
Right.
Spatial imaging project, and I wonder.
And asymmetries have been reported in some of the brain measures.
Yes.
I'm not so sure. We'd have to go back and look at the frontal lobe, but I believe there was an asymmetry there as well when they looked at distance from the center of the brain.
Right.
That there may have been some asymmetries. That's an interesting question.
And
to correlate that if there are asymmetries in palpebral fissure size.
Right.
Asymmetries in frontal lobes.
We should have all those data from the repository.
Right.
On palpebral fissure size.
Brain measurements may not totally be in the repository yet. That database, I think, is still being developed. But
simply knowing even whether there are asymmetries in palpebral fissure size would be interesting.
Right, and that data we should. I mean, I've gotten this week from Leela, who's Ken's data person, they went through the whole database to try to get rid of duplicates and to identify those 5% where they had 5% error rate in data entry or on the forms that they were using, that where they had incomplete forms, et cetera. So she just sent that to me. So they're updating the dysmorphology database. So I would imagine within a week or two, when that's all completed, it should be very easy to find out.
Yeah.
Whether or not there are those asymmetries.
I'll send a little note to Tatiana and copy some of you and see if she can help us with that.
Okay. Just Brian's stuff. He found very small areas in the right hemisphere, parietal lobe, that had increased cortical thickness, and some at the junction of the temporal and parietal lobes, and a small amount in the temporal lobe. And again, there were asymmetries. He didn't see as much in the left hemisphere at all. So just a little bit in the frontal lobe, he found some cortical thickness, prefrontal lobe. So, I mean, there's distinct differences between his data and Elizabeth's.
Yeah.
Do you know if the paper that on ultrasound measures that Dr. Hull had in preparation or whatever, has that been published yet?
I believe it was out as part of a meeting summary that they had, the Smith meeting.
Could you
I'll look and I'll try to send that to you.
Yeah, yeah, I'd love to have that.
And me as well.
Okay, I'll send it out to everybody, or we should even have it on the web if it's published. And then I guess most of you have seen, you know, Sandy Jacobson's eye blink conditioning.
Yes.
Study that came out the other day.
Yes.
In Acer. And so you may also want to look at that. Charlie, in that eye blink stuff.
Yes.
Did you look at her paper?
I have downloaded it. I have read through parts of it. I didn't read it in fine detail.
Okay.
I've talked to Mark about it.
Is that pretty in humans that to get such poor eye blink conditioning?
It,
I mean, like they were using like 40%.
Yeah, and it will, you know, it will be dependent on the quality of the setup, but humans will typically not, you know, normal adult humans will not get conditioning, you know, above 75% or 80%.
Okay.
And children, I suspect, would be, you know, more consistent with what they saw. You know, it can be reduced. So it's about as good as you're going to get, I think, for what they were trying to do.
I found that none of the FAS kids conditioned.
They showed no conditioning, basically.
Over 3 days or three sessions of testing compared to about 75% of unexposed controls who did learn the condition response.
And it's, you know, that's
pretty interesting.
You don't get above 75% normally. So, I mean, that's probably accurate.
Any other issues that we think that we need to discuss?
I have one, Ed. One thing to raise. I've talked with Tatiana about this, and this is something that came up in our meeting. The prospect for doing facial imaging in the sheep with the new three-dimensional camera imaging approach that they're using, where they're they're taking, you know, multiple images from the sheep from different cameras and integrating those images. I think Tim and I are both pretty interested in the possibility of seeing whether that can be applied to sheep. I talked with Jeff Rogers here briefly. He's not convinced that, you know, he doesn't know whether the, you know, the hair on the sheep and other differences that might interfere with the data mapping make it possible, but we're interested in trying to pilot that out in an animal to see if we can get it to provide a usable database. There are a couple ways to do it. One is for us to locate a farmer or some research station here to let us come out and try to take pictures of sheep.
Right.
Or to have Elizabeth or someone else take it at some point down to Texas A&M to see if we can do it down there.
Mm-hmm.
What's your idea on the way to go about trying to pilot this out?
Well, she has not come up with any timetable for the distribution of those cameras.
Right.
I know she was trying to find cameras that were already available at sites,
right,
similar cameras that were already available at sites. But it seems that in somewhere in Indiana, there must be a sheep real close by.
Yeah, that's what we thought too.
Simply just go out and photograph the silly thing.
Yeah.
And
well, next Monday is a day they're going to be basically all day piloting this out in humans. I'm going to be part of that. I'm going to look, you know, sit in on part of that, see how it works, and talk with Jeff in more detail.
I mean, I take that camera out to a petting zoo and.
Yeah. Well, it's the thing we'll have to do is just have cooperation from somebody, you know, outside the university. But I think it's worth a shot to see if we can get it to work.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I agree. Totally. Yeah. All right. So everything else is running smooth. I know it hasn't been that long since we met. So.
So.
Anything from Susan? NIAAA's
I have nothing at all.
Okay, Lori?
Nope, I'm fine.
All right, Dan?
I don't think there's anything to add just yet, Ed.
All right. Jim?
Probably not. Before the call, I was just wondering if anybody anticipated any problems. If there's anything that might be.
I think everything is okay so far.
Okay, good.
All right, Michael, any last comments?
No. Go Sox.
Okay. Oh, yeah. Sorry about that game.
Oh, my God. I haven't processed it. I'm sort of not dealing with it. I still haven't processed Aaron Boone's home run in the 2003 ALCS, so it's going to stay in the same place, I think.
For a while. But it was a good game.
It depends on how you look at it.
I mean, just keep recalling the game up to the last 2 minutes, and you're fine.
I do. That's basically what I've been doing, but I seem to be alone here and feeling so gleeful.
I've been feeling it for 3 weeks.
Well, you know, I'm an old New Jersey boy, so you know where my allegiance had to be. Although, you know, Eli Manning refused to play for the Chargers, so he was not a real favorite here. Well, thank you very much, everybody. And
right.
We'll talk next week and look at that paper I just sent. And
Ed, I haven't gotten that yet. I don't know if it takes
either.
A while to get out, but I've got it.
Yeah, it's all right.
Oh, some of them came back. I'm sorry. I was just putting together addresses here. So I'll send it out again. I'll go through the...
Mine came, so thank you.
Right. Okay, because it says Lori Fowden's came back, so...
Yeah.
Oh, that's good. I'll send it to your NIAAA address. Okay.
Yes, do please send it to the home one.
I will. All righty.
All right.
But I'll make sure that it gets out. Carl, you didn't get it?
I didn't get it. I still don't have it yet. But
me either.
I don't either.
All right. I'll send another set.
Okay.
And
all righty.
Is Faye still on the line?
I'm on.
Faye, I'm going to send you an email.
Okay.
Do I the email that I have listed for you, does that work?
F Broadwater at, yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Is this Tim?
This is Charlie.
Yeah. Send that, yeah, please. Yeah, send me an email.
Okay.
FBroadwater@Verizon.net.
Okay. Thank you.
All righty.
Okay, take care.
Okay,
take
care. Now.
Right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
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 Bye.